Welcome to TWiL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on May the 5th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
Today we are joined by Glenn Cohen, professor of law at Harvard Law School and the faculty director of Harvard's Petri Flom Center for Health Law Policy. Welcome, Glenn.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so... We always have some thorny questions to sort out from this week's news and law. Frank, where are you going to take us first?
Yes, so one of the biggest issues in the news recently was the terrible earthquake in Nepal. And one of the sideline stories, or a story that has not gotten a huge amount of attention, but that I thought would be really interesting to be analyzed by Glenn today, is one about surrogate children who were born there and rescued, but the surrogates were left behind or perhaps not helped as much as, say, bioethical principles of benefit sharing or other bioethical principles might dictate. And so given Glenn's work, The Globalization of Healthcare, Legal and Ethical Challenges, a book from 2013 that I think is one of the, if not the, most authoritative accounts of the impact of globalization on healthcare, I thought we could ask Glenn, what is your take on the ethical dilemmas here and any ways in which law might impact the actions taken with respect to these surrogate babies?
Great. Well, thank you for the question, Frank. So as you noted, Time magazine reported this week that an Israeli Boeing 747 was sent to Nepal from Ben-Gurion in Tel Aviv, basically right after the earthquake. And among the passengers were about 15 Israeli babies, all of whom had been born to surrogates in Nepal. Surrogacy has become a big thing in Nepal as of late, in part because of a tightening up of commercial surrogacy in India. So we no longer have commercial surrogacy to India. And most of the people who've been going from Israel have been gay men because commercial surrogacy, and especially for gay men, very hard to do in Israel. You're not allowed to basically be gay and use a surrogate in Israel. So Israel has essentially outsourced much of the supply for surrogacy for gay men. And the end result is that a lot of these surrogates in Nepal actually started off as being surrogates in India. But when India tightened up its own law to basically prohibit surrogacy or restrict surrogacy for gay men, many of those Indian women moved across the border to Nepal. And Israel dispatched planes to carry forth the babies, and so I believe some of the pregnant women, but many of the women who had served as surrogates were left behind, essentially. And so there's a few ethical issues here. One has to do with the whole notion of essentially outsourcing your ethical problems. Should a country that prohibits surrogacy at home essentially also prohibit the same activity extraterritorially, or should it look the other way and allow its citizens to go abroad and do it? And I recently finished a book called Patients with Passports about medical tourism more generally, and this is one of a series of types of what I call circumvention tourism, travel for abortion, for assisted suicide, for reproductive technology, where the country criminalizes it at home but doesn't criminalize it if you go abroad to do it. And I think there's some thorny moral issues raised by that. And presumptively, my own view is that you should have a symmetrical policy in terms of what you do at home and abroad. And then apart from that, there is a question more generally of what we owe women who serve as surrogates, and whether this is another instance of exploitation of people in the developing world. And I think a lot of people saw this visual of the mothers being left behind, the babies being taken, as a real sign or a real emblem of exploitation of these women. My own view is it's a little bit more complicated than that. We can talk about it. But I think this story has really resonated with a lot of people who may have been willing to countenance a certain amount of surrogacy tourism, but when they see this, find it hard to ignore.
So this is basically regulatory arbitrage then?
That is exactly right. That essentially Israel knows that it can forbid gay people to have surrogacy because it knows many of its individuals will go abroad in order to do it. And there are countries like France, for example, that make it much more difficult if you violate, if you basically you can't do commercial surrogacy in France. If you go to the U.S. and engage in commercial surrogacy, France and other European countries have made it quite difficult to get children nationalized as a way to try to deter this. And you could also, in theory, have it be a crime not only domestically but extraterritorially to do this kind of activity. Israel has done really neither of those things. It's really allowing this foreign, out of sight, out of mind practice to persist while prohibiting the practice domestically.
It really does raise some difficult questions, and it reminds me, I guess, of some of the cases involving, I think, women in Ireland trying to get to the UK for abortions. And it raises really deep, and I mean, on a note of comparing some of the politics in the States, I think there was a brief filed this week in the Supreme Court saying that permitting gay marriage would lead to more abortions, which I thought was, was received with some ridicule in some quarters. But I think it's very interesting to note that there are, that this is not a new problem. And that's part of what I like so much about your work, Glenn, is that you situate all of these questions of arbitrage and of efforts to avoid certain nations' laws by going out of the nation in a larger historical background. So I guess, do you think that the policy prescriptions that you've offered in Patients Without Passports are going to affect the debate in some of these countries? Or how would that play out here, do you think?
So I'm definitely hopeful. And I should also say Nick has written a lot of wonderful stuff in this area, and I often return to his work in the area. I tend to think of the issues of travel for assisted suicide, travel for abortion, and travel for reproductive technology to circumvent domestic law to really be on the same footing. And my own view is if you have a very good reason that you've convinced yourself as a home country to criminalize the activity at home, it requires some fancy footwork to understand why you don't want to criminalize it when your citizen goes abroad. Now, maybe the reproductive technology cases are different because to the extent there's exploitation occurring, it's exploitation not of your own citizen by your citizen, but of a non-citizen in India or Nepal, where that government has declared it not exploitative or not illegal. So maybe it's a little bit more complicated in that instance. But as a kind of prima facie matter, I think if you think you have good reasons to outlaw it at home, it's probably morally incumbent upon you to determine whether you're just outsourcing your problem by letting it happen to other people abroad, or whether, in fact, it would be better to make it more symmetrical. I think the question of citizenship for these kids is even tougher. Everybody loves children, as we should, and I think it's very easy to have an attitude that this is punishing the child for the sins of the parent. On the other hand, I think if you flip the question around and say, who is entitled to U.S. or Canadian or French citizenship? And if someone were to smuggle a child across the border or fake the child's provenance, often in American law and Canadian law and the like, we have a problem with that. So the question is the law violation occurring here different in an important way? And how much deterrent value would there be if we stood fast and say, no immigration for these children? It's a terrible, terrible price to pay in that you're essentially often creating children who are stateless. But I actually think it's a more complicated question and more open to debate than many people who I think just have a knee-jerk reaction that children shouldn't suffer for their parents' crimes. I think that's a little bit of a too simplistic a framing.
Got it. I mean, that is really a very a series of moral issues that are not at all apparent on the surface of this story. But as you recount them, I mean, clearly challenge any sort of effort by policymakers to sort of say throw open the doors to globalized use of medical resources in order to, say, create a safety valve for their own citizens who might be chafing against the restrictions within the home country.
An extra gloss or interesting aspect of this is that it's gay men who are mostly doing this, and whether that changes your analysis. I mean, you could see someone saying you're talking about a group that's already disenfranchised at home, right? Israeli birth and marriage is governed by religious law, hence why gay men are largely shut out of this market. And you might say that that element adds a question about whether what they're doing is kind of trying to vindicate their human rights, if you think the right to reproduce genetically is a kind of human right. So I think that that dimension adds yet another set of ethical problems and difficulties, which is why I think this topic is endlessly fascinating.
Another area where we could see some tourism, some arbitrage, is in mitochondrial replacement therapy. And Glenn, your the new piece with your co-authors in Insights, published in Science, really was very helpful in trying to peel back the layers and layers of ignorance I have with regard to this subject. So perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the issues that have been coming up, particularly the differences between the US and the UK with regard to this type of treatment.
Absolutely. So let me just start with a very basic primer on the science, right? You remember back to high school biology, you've got the cell. The mitochondria are essentially the battery pack. It's a little bit of a simplification, but I think it's not a bad one, of our cells. And there's organelles that have their own genes called mitochondrial DNA. When these don't work properly, women who carry kind of mutant mitochondrial DNA give rise, their reproduction gives rise to a broad range of heritable clinical syndromes. And really, these are quite awful for children who end up suffering from these diseases. Well, very recently, it's been 10 years in the making, but very recently, we're at a point where essentially we can take the mitochondrial DNA from one woman, the battery pack, combine it with the nuclear DNA from another woman, the genetic mother, as it's normally thought, and the sperm from the father, and we can produce a baby. Now, media has been calling this three-parent IVF or three-parent reproduction. I think that's probably not the best term for it because it seems to presume the conclusion of the argument that all of these three people are to be regarded as a parent and what that means, and we can kind of unpack that. But the big news is that this is now here. In the UK, we have the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, the HFEA, which is an independent regulatory agency established by Parliament, and it essentially licenses individual uses and individual clinics. And it was asked to license to the Newcastle Centre basically mitochondrial replacement as not just a research or experimental technique, but a clinical license. This looked to many as though it was in violation of the organic statute, and the result was that Parliament took up the question about whether they should allow the licensing of this. Around the same time, this is in December, so around the same December to February, around the same time FDA held a hearing. FDA ultimately said, we're not going to decide. They've referred the matter to the Institute of Medicine, whereas the UK, both the House of Commons and then the House of Lords, has approved this mitochondrial replacement therapy. So as you say, Nick, we may see some medical tourism to the UK for women who suffer from mitochondrial disease or have heritable mitochondrial disease to have reproduction in this way. And among the many issues here, we can talk about the two regulatory experiences. We can talk about what it means to be the mitochondrial donor. But I think what's quite fascinating here is that this is happening at the same moment in time where a series of other technologies are becoming available that I know we'll talk about later today, CRISPR-Cas9, which is a gene editing, and the possibility of germline, which is heritable alterations, not merely somatic cell alterations, ordinarily are not heritable.
So you take the, you make the distinction for the purposes of the germline, that microchondrial replacement is different from, or has very different issues compared to the CRISPR techniques.
Yeah, I do. And again, so to be clear, in the mitochondrial replacement therapy, what we're bringing in from a third parent is very small amounts of mitochondrial DNA. I think it's estimated to be around 0.054%, so less than 1% of the total DNA. And the people I talk to who do this, the scientists and also embryologists who I talk to, the view is kind of uniformly that this kind of foreign DNA being brought in from a third party is not going to have much of an effect on the phenotype, the expressed gene characteristics. It's really going to be hard to see what impact, if any, it's going to have. Whereas I think with CRISPR-Cas9 and gene alteration, here we are talking about altering the nuclear DNA, which is much more likely to have effects on phenotype. And also there's a lot more unpredictability, I think people in the field will tell you. But among the things that's interesting, so as you may know, the UK has a rule that you can't be an anonymous sperm or egg donor. All sperm or egg donors have to have their names put into a registry of everyone involved. So when a child turns 18, they can access that name. Well, they explicitly said the mitochondrial donor, the person who's donating the mitochondrial DNA, is not a parent for these purposes. That person can remain anonymous. And I think that does kind of indicate to you that the term three-parent IVF or three-parent reproduction is a little bit of a misnomer. I don't want to denigrate the contribution of these women who are donating mitochondrial DNA, but it would be like swapping out the battery in your iPhone, the old flip phones. I'm dating myself a little bit. If I asked you, is that still your phone? If we swapped out the battery pack and put in a new battery pack, I think most people would say, no, that is from my phone. It is the data, the contacts, what I visited, what apps I have, not so much the battery pack. And I think that really is the difference between Cas9, CRISPR on the one hand, and mitochondrial replacement on the other. Mitochondrial replacement is about switching the battery pack. Cas9 CRISPR is about switching the actual phone.
So is there a consensus building amongst ethicists in this country, Glenn, as to sort of which side of the so-called red line this falls?
So it was interesting. Among other things, in the debate in Parliament, it turns out that there's an EU provision relating to germline therapy. And in the parliamentary debate, there was a long discussion about whether this was germline or not. And I think the view of the people who voted for it, the majority both in the House of Commons and the House of Lords, was this was not germline therapy. That that is your red line. This is on the okay side of it. Again, it's a little bit inaccurate. My own view is it's not so much the distinction between germline or not, but between alterations that matter and alterations that do not matter. And I think the MRT and mitochondrial replacement therapy, it's just that the actual alterations you're making, not only I think is it defensible to say that they're not germline, but more importantly, I think, is that they seem relatively inconsequential, whereas Cas9 CRISPR seems as though it's potentially consequential alterations on the one hand and also pretty clearly germline alterations on the other. So if it's a 2x2 matrix, MRT, mitochondrial replacement, is on the okay side or on the okay side of the red line in both dimensions, whereas Cas9 CRISPR looks like it's on the over the red line on both sides of the other. But I'm not at all sure that FDA and IOM will actually be okay with mitochondrial replacement therapy, in part because in the U.S., this is also embroiled with the politics of embryo destruction. In order to do mitochondrial replacement therapy, many of the forms involve a predictable amount of embryo destruction, and that alone may distinguish this in the United States political environment.
Yes, that does sound like a very different set of ethical debates that would be relevant. One of the things that I noticed from your article in Science was a comment in the American context, to move this a little bit away from the ethical questions to the safety concerns, or I guess they're all ethical questions, but just to change the ethical debate a little bit, the focus of it. You stated there, or you mentioned that the FDA made a statement about, or Reuters quoted the chairman of the committee with saying that several panelists felt there was probably not enough data in animals to move on to human trials without answering a few additional questions. Do you have a sense of whether the is this a sort of formalism that's at play here, where essentially the responsible American decision makers there feel that essentially we've got to get more data in the context of animal studies before moving ahead? Or do you think that there are some safety concerns that, say, really are important to address before, say, moving in ahead with the human uses here?
You know, so my sense is there's pulls both ways. On the one hand, I think the Brits were predisposed to liking this and feeling comfortable with it, in part for national pride reasons. This is research that was really pioneered by Newcastle, and I think was a real source. It was fascinating when you listen to the House of Commons and House of Lords debate, how much even the opponents were important for them to recognize what a wonderful, you know, thing this was, that the UK was leading the field here. So that cuts one way in favor of the UK. You know, my own sense, and I'm not a scientist or embryologist, but my co-author, one of them at least, is. And, you know, reading the tea leaves, my own sense is that there's not a lot that we don't know that we're going to learn from additional studies. There have been a large number of studies. And my own sense is that the people at FDA who have said these out loud, and FDA's desire to kind of push the ball to IOM for a while, have much more to do with kind of people who would rather there be a delay or a moratorium, and they're using this as the predominant language or idea why they're doing it. In all the research that we've seen, I don't think the concerns about safety have really been borne out. And to the extent they're concerns, I think they're more metaphysical or ethical concerns, but these people at FDA can't quite say that. So I think that they are, you know, pushing the line of safety. I mean, it's, as you know, as somebody who works in the space, both of you now, when you're always with approving a new therapeutic or a new product, faced with a question of how much uncertainty you're willing to tolerate, and at what point you need to do one more study, one more study, one more study. And there's no right answer to this, but there are these women who would like to have genetic reproduction, and one answer could just be, hey, guess what? You should be adopting, you know, families. Nobody, though, has articulated that argument in saying that this whole research is unnecessary because these people could just decide not to be a genetic parent. I think baked into the U.S. Mindset on this is a view that the goal of genetic parenthood, even if aided by technology and a mitochondrial donor, is a worthwhile one.
That makes a lot of sense, and that really helps contextualize this. I mean, I guess we saw this in so many debates. I mean, I remember most recently with Dodd-Frank, all of the studies that were commissioned about, say, issues in finance, rather than going directly at them. I guess PPACA had lots of studies in it as well before, you know, imposing lots of pilot programs before imposing, say, a more general system change. So that is sort of a general strategy of delay, and it is very interesting here. Well, unless there's more on the mitochondrial issue, this mitochondrial transfer issue, or the so-called three parenting approach, I was wondering if we could move on to the larger, the I think more sensational, bigger news item in China, coming out of the use of the CRISPR technique in terms of editing genes there. Could you introduce our audience to that controversy, Glenn, and focus on, say, some of the things that distinguish it from the situation in England?
Yeah, absolutely. So CRISPR-Cas9 is a system that basically allows people who have knowledge of molecular biology to modify the genome, and making us able to do things that were difficult or impossible to do. And while this is not DIY in your garage, it is kind of within the bailiwick of, I think, most sophisticated researchers here. So controlling this technique is quite difficult. It enables you to introduce DNA sequences that correct genetic defects, such as replacing mutated gene underlying a metabolic disease involving the liver in a mouse. We've done that. You can also basically sequence changes in embryonic stem cells so they could be cultured to produce specific tissues. And essentially what's really important here is that the kinds of differentiation or changes you can make with CRISPR-Cas9 is not just the somatic cells of animals, plants, or human beings, but you could essentially change the nuclei of the reproductive cells that transmit information from one generation to the next. So this will be carried throughout an organism's life, and most importantly, be passed on to any descendants it creates through reproduction. So we can basically, and the term editing, I think, is an interesting one. Again, the image, a little bit of a simplification here, is imagining the editor in the studio editing a film and splicing in a different take rather than this take, now splicing in a different gene for this gene. And just like we now create DVDs, once you put it back together, the DVD or the film can be reproduced indefinitely, right? And every version will have that new scene in it. So every version may carry forward the genetic change that you make. So many people have regarded this as a red line, a moratorium, and there was an article in Science involving very prominent people calling for a moratorium, just as like the one that came out of the Sillimar conference in the 70s about genetic engineering. But lo and behold, as soon as this is published, I think this was published in April 3rd or April 10th, by April 20th, we have a report that Chinese scientists have already gone ahead and edited the genomes of human embryos. They tried to get it published, but the Science and Nature reportedly refused because of concerns regarding the ethics. But essentially, they modified the gene responsible for beta thalassemia, which is a potentially fatal blood disorder, using the CRISPR-Cas9 technique. And so what looked like science fiction or looked like something on the horizon that all of these very smart bioethicists and scientists were saying, let's issue a moratorium, let's do a moratorium, we want to prevent this, already within the space of 20 days, has become a reality. Now, none of these embryos were implanted. They didn't go that far. But that would have been the next step if they had wanted to, right, just to actually bring them to term and produce these children.
I was just wondering about that, Glenn, because I think that it is amazing that that would have been the next step. Apparently, though, they stated that that there was something that they promised not to bring them to term. Is that right?
That's right. And there is no plan to do so, as far as I know. But we've gone from proof of concept in animals to actually doing it in human beings. And you know, it is possible that these embryos. I think the 71 embryos survived. They injected 86 embryos. 71 survived. They genetically tested 54. Of those, about 28 were successfully spliced. So it's only a fraction of those that they altered actually contain the replacement genetic material. And had they implanted them, who knows how many would have successfully implanted. But certainly we're now at the place where you need some sophistication and some resources. But it's not at all clear that many people across the world couldn't do this exact thing that was done, and maybe they wouldn't have stopped. Maybe they would have gone forward and actually implanted the embryos.
And this does appear to me to be an area where there is a rift that is opening between several scientists, I think, on the cutting edge of the science, and, say, the ethical and political communities governing science in a lot of nations. I mean, I remember hearing a talk or hearing Craig Mello, a Nobel Prize-winning professor of molecular medicine, who didn't seem to think there was that huge an issue here. And I also recently was commenting on a piece on synthetic biology by David Graywall, looking at the future regulation of synthetic biology and you know, pretty openly contemplating, or at least quoting folks who are contemplating, a synthetic biological approach to re-engineering certain aspects of human beings. And I was wondering, do you think that there is that rift opening, Glenn, or do you think that that is still somewhat of a fringe position even among scientists to permit this germline changes to the to human embryos?
So it's interesting. I think there are some factions being formed, and they're going to create some interesting bedfellows. On the one hand, there's a faction that I think of, you know, Leon Cass, Michael Sandel sometimes, a group of people who I think have a view rooted in either a secular kind of metaphysical view about what human beings are, or an explicitly religious view, like Imago Dei, about the image of God and the like, who essentially think that tampering with the genome, whatever the consequences that might arise, is per se morally problematic and ought to be prohibited. Then I think there's a group of people who are trying to get ahead of regulation by trying to organize internal to science moratoriums like Asilomar. Some of them are people who I think don't want this research ever to occur. Others are people who I think are afraid that if science itself doesn't clean its own house and have a temporary moratorium, the result will instead be a hard law permanent moratorium. Then I think there's a group of people who have some concerns about the techniques and the technology and some concerns about the consequences, but those concerns are at least in theory defeasible, right? That there might be a set of guidelines or a set of studies or a set of discussions that might actually enable them to think that in some forms genome editing would be okay. And I think what's interesting is that there is a jockeying for position among these groups. And what's making it even more complicated is the lack of a transnational kind of regulatory apparatus. Concern that, as we did with, you know, stem cell work in the United States and some states at various points in time, a concern that if we prohibited it with hard law here in the U.S., we might drive it to places that have weaker regulatory structures, for example, and that therefore regulating this, even if you wanted to, is a complex undertaking.
Continually, I think that we do science very badly here. Whenever it touches our political or legal discourse. And science, of course, is also its own enemy because it tends to move so fast. As you pointed out, Glenn, there we were about to have a nicer sort of academic discussion about CRISPR and not get all panicked about it, and suddenly the papers are full of Chinese DNA editing. Do you think we have the institutions here to enable or facilitate sensible discussion? Obviously, the IOM you've already mentioned. Or do you think that some of the points you make in the Nature article, Glenn, about the sort of depoliticized scientific institutions set up in the UK to deal with this offer some better routes? I think it's something that the UK does do fairly regularly. Obviously, we're all familiar with the NICE, N-I-C-E, group that does cost-effectiveness work and so on.
Yeah, so it's a great question, Nick. So a couple of reactions. The first is that in FDA, you have a general all-purpose regulator of therapeutics, drugs and devices, right? And part of their mandate will sweep in mitochondrial replacement therapy, genome editing probably as well. But it's not a specialized agency, and it's not an agency that has particular expertise here, whereas in the UK, you do have an agency that's focused on reproductive technology. I also think what's nice about the UK regulatory structure is that you can license individual clinics and individual usage, which I think helps put notches on the slippery slope. So that's the second thing that I think is in favor of the UK approach. And then the third is just to say that if in the US, essentially this is going to put a lot of pressure on Congress or the executive to be the one to act. And I think that so much of the politics of abortion infects, in a way, these decisions about these particular technologies, that it makes it hard to have a conversation about these technologies that's reasoned, that is not a proxy war in terms of voting about abortion. And I think, you know, the President's Commission and the IOM are nice. They give reasoned reports and make recommendations, but the translation from those recommendations to lawmaking is not at all a very sure path. In my own view, you know, again, if you like prohibitory stance, I think it is the case that Congress is more likely to prohibit than is the UK. But if you think that there might be something short of that that would be more desirable, you're less likely to get it.
Well, that is just a fantastic tour of some really cutting-edge bioethical issues, Glenn. And I really appreciate both the legal specificity about particular issues and your, you know, ability to seamlessly weave that into the larger political and ethical stakes of them. And now, just to make our final transition for the program, Nick and I always have one or two issues that just sort of come out of the healthcare news of the week. And to sort of balance our bioethical discussion this week, we just wanted to spend a few minutes alerting listeners to a lot of news stories about a new Uber-like startup in the home healthcare space, which I think is going to raise a lot of cutting-edge legal issues. This startup is called Honor. It is being pushed by venture capitalist Mark Andreessen, who's, you know, at the center of a lot of big action in Silicon Valley to shake up other industries. He wrote a famous editorial in the Wall Street Journal called Software Eats the World, where he essentially predicted that software, after sort of eating up a lot of journalism, a lot of the internet space, was going to go into traditional industries. And now he's pushing one in the healthcare space. And this is essentially an Uber for home healthcare. It's an entity that's going to have a platform where you go onto the platform, and just as you might find a car via Uber, you're going to find a home healthcare aid for need for family members who need home healthcare. The promise is that they'll pay almost double what, say, home healthcare aides earn now as employees. That instead of the $9 or so an hour that they make there, that would be $17 an hour. However, I saw no journalism that quoted what home health aides who are independent contractors usually make, which I've heard is a figure of around $20 an hour. So that's one way in which, you know, maybe there's a little bit of an over-promising here by the entity. But also, what I thought was really interesting about what Honor is doing is that most of the time, these entities like Uber like to say that we are just a platform, that we are not actually the employer, et cetera, and try to hold their drivers or the people who are using their platform out at a distance. Honor is trying to distinguish itself by saying that we're going to really vet the home health care aides that we bring in, and we're going to train them to some extent, citing the example of the Apple Genius Bar. They think if you can bring Apple Genius Bar level of service to home health care, that will be a vast improvement. So I just, you know, as someone that thinks a bit about digital labor, I think that this is a bit of a minefield, actually, that they may not be completely aware of all the sort of hiccups or problems that could happen. The most important being that when, say, someone finds a really good person via Honor, what's going to prevent them from simply hiring them, you know, rather than paying the cut to Honor as the platform. And so I was just wondering, you know, does any other thoughts about the legal issues here, other problems that might be raised?
So you would usually expect at this point, Frank, probably my usual rant about describing anything as the Uber of something. But actually, this is a good example, I think, where use of that name is appropriate, because I think, like you, I view some of these services as essentially not being high-tech services. These are not software services or products. These are essentially methods of getting people with needs in contact with an extremely low-paid workforce. Disintermediating or rather disrupting some existing models. They do set themselves a high bar here if they're going to do any proper vetting. They're going surely to have to deal with state regulations with regard to some of these issues. And I think the reimbursement question is very hard. There is no reimbursement at this point, it would appear, for these services. So I think we'll continue to see these kinds of sort of healthcare sort of concierge services. In LA, I think there's a smartphone app called Heal, H-E-A-L, that will bring you a doctor to your door within a certain number of minutes. And there's a similar service, I think, in New York called Pager. So we'll see lots of these sort of little local things coming up. And the question is, will reimbursement follow? Will they get traction?
That is really a critical question. And I'm glad you brought up the New York service and others, because there was actually something called CareLinks as well that's been around for, I think, 4 years or so. And it has been trying to pioneer that model. I do also know that in New York, there was at least one person that tried to bring back house calls, but found himself at odds with various regulatory bodies there. So I think it is going to be just something to watch, but definitely an area where, as I've been saying, in much of the startup space, I think many of these startups really would benefit from some legal advice from health law experts, because it's just, as the title of one of your articles, Nick's, puts it, it is a highly regulated domain that they are entering.
Well, that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Glenn Cohen. Glenn is at C-O-H-E-N-P-R-O-F. That's at CohenProf on Twitter. Glenn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we post our show notes at twill.com. That's T-W-I-H-L.com. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry. That's N-I-C-O-L-A-S-T-E-R-R-Y on Twitter. And Frank, where can you be found?
I can be found both at Frank Pasquale on Twitter and at HealthPI for at Health Privacy Innovation.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.